This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The number of women who've come forward with testimonies of sexual harassment and assault grows larger by the day. This recent surge has put sexual misconduct and toxic masculinity in the national discourse, but questions remain. For instance, do we treat black and white accusers differently? That is one of the questions we'll ask on today's installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. Joining me now are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thanks, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
How are you doing, Frank?
Natalie, let's talk about this. All of these stories now emerging, more by the day. Give us the big picture. What's your take on all of this?
I mean, I've really been struggling with it all because I really think on the one hand that it's stunning in a good way that so many cases have come out. I think I read, I can't remember if it's the New York Times or the Washington Post, there's like 30 men, white men, actually, that have been accused and like their feet held to the fire for sexual assault, rape, sexual harassment, what have you. And so it's good because the accusers are being heard. I mean, yeah, the accusers are being heard. Their voices are, even if it's after 30 years, are finally, you know, meeting the light of day. But at the same time, I feel like the response to the survivors is, you know, a mixed bag. Like, I'm not really sure whether or not we are at a moment where women's concerns and safety and our right to not be groped and assaulted is really at the heart of the outrage. It seems to me that there's something else going on, which I really have not quite figured out. But I don't believe that we're at like a watershed moment where now, you know, accusers are going to feel so much more encouraged to speak out, because I feel like there's something else going on.
Well, let me ask you that, because we do have, in this case, immediate responses. We've got film companies pulling films. We have you have Mitch McConnell, a Republican Senate, the head of the Republican Party in the U.S. Senate, saying, "I believe her." All right. Would you have expected that? Would you have predicted that 2 months
Not
ago?
Not at all.
I mean, there is that. There is that kind of response where people are being fired, their films are being pulled immediately, not waiting for any kind of tribunal to weigh the evidence.
Right.
Isn't that a difference?
I think that is. I do think that that is. At the same time, like, what's the motivation? You know, for instance, with Mitch McConnell, like, I think that there is a political motivation that is at play with his response. I appreciate him saying he believes the women, but I'm not sure I believe him completely. With someone like Harvey Weinstein or any of the men who are in entertainment and who are, you know, in Hollywood, I think media and entertainment companies are breaking company with these men because that's good business. That, like, they don't want their names associated with someone who's been accused of sexual assault. So I'm still not, I hear you. I think that there are some responses that are sincere. But as a whole, I'm just not sure that we're at a place where, you know, this is really about people believing women, caring about the fact that this happens every day and in arenas that no one will ever hear about. Two women who will never speak out about it, you know, or is there something else going on?
Mark?
It would be easy to say that we're at a moment where suddenly corporations have become woke, around gender, at least, and gender violence. But I don't think that's the case necessarily, right? It's on the one hand a recognition that perhaps there are now more women in these boardrooms to provide another voice around these kind of issues. But if there's a reckoning, I think the reckoning is a recognition of the ways in which women drive certain consumer products, how they drive consumption. And the fact that they've, you know, so many folks have been able to successfully utilize social media as a way to articulate what that power is. Mm-hmm. When you see these film companies, when you see the case with Charlie Rose and how quickly these corporations really fell in line to fire people and what have you, it really speaks to the fear of the kind of power that, that women have, at least in the marketplace. The irony is that you might think that someone like Mitch McConnell might be reacting to the power that women might have in the voting booth. But the fact that the current president was elected by such an overwhelming amount by white women, you know, more than a majority of them, suggested that might not be the case. I think in the case of someone like Mitch McConnell and many of the GOP who claim that they are supportive and they believe these women, it actually comes down to a fact that they are just find Roy Moore so distasteful.
I'm going to push back on that just a little bit, because what he could have said is, as a politician, I've heard this a million times. Yeah, absolutely. He doesn't want to see Roy Moore. He felt a blow. He lost when Roy Moore won the primary. What he can say is, I think he needs to step down. I don't want to weigh in on who's right and who's wrong. I don't want to get into the he said, she said, but it's a distraction and he should step down. He could have gotten away with that. What he didn't have to say, and I find this, and I'm not sure what it means either, so I'm only asking the question, but I will say, since he didn't have to say, I believe the woman, and since that is not necessarily the mantra of the Republican Party, it did seem like a remarkable statement.
Right, mm-hmm. Something that could have been genuine, mm-hmm. right? And I think, you know, the fact that we're experiencing this, it's like they're breaking news alerts every 5 minutes, right? It feels like an epidemic, but I'm with Natalie. It doesn't feel as though something has really shifted just yet.
Isn't it? But let me ask you this. Even if it is the marketplace speaking, which is frankly the only place we really have any vote anymore, if you've noticed, the fact is that doesn't that mean something? Doesn't it mean that consumers now are woke to the fact that I'm not going to take this anymore? That's a political or a consumer ethic, and if you go past the line, you risk not being able to sell your product. Doesn't that mean something?
I mean, that's an important power, and I think it is, you know, definitely true that in this age of social media that we're able to mobilize around issues and definitely have an influence on the outcomes of situations in a way that, you know, was not possible prior to the advent of social media. But at the same time, it's like I'm thinking about Fenty Beauty, Rihanna's line, right? And the fact that so many mainstream, I'll call them, cosmetics company, once Rihanna came out with her 40 shades of foundation, now here they come trying to, you know, do the same thing, but it's not sincere. So that marketplace, that marketplace motivation or incentive, it's shallow. It doesn't really mean anything at the end of the day. It's not the type of thing that's going to shift the culture and cause us to truly care about and deal with rape culture and sexual assault as it not only applies to women and girls, but boys and men as well.
And I think we're in an interesting place in terms of really having a conversation about where sexual violence is in this country, because there is a difference, right? Distinction to be made from groping in the workforce to rape.
Yeah.
And at the moment, we're conflating so many of these issues so that, you know, in some ways, the lowest hanging fruit is what dominates the conversation. Mm-hmm. In some ways, we've forgotten about Weinstein, right, who is wielding his power and his privilege and, quite frankly, his penis in mm-hmm. a way mm-hmm. that impacted upon the lives of women that's very different than, you know, what we might think of as what has passed off in the past as kind of recreational groping. Now, we've never had a conversation about what that means also and what it means to expose women in the workforce and other places to that. But let's not conflate the two things. We're really dealing with a range of issues around sexual violence and sexual harassment that all need to be addressed with a certain kind of specificity if we're going to be able to take it seriously in terms of the impact that it has on women.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that we are, maybe it's because so many cases have come out and they're all so, you know, they run the gamut. Yeah. It's easy to conflate. But at the same time, I really feel like there is a cost or a price to be paid when you allow even the least bit to happen.
Yep.
That it snowballs.
Right.
And eventually, if groping is allowed, then we are going to get to a point where rape and sexual assault is allowed. And we see that. I mean, clearly, that is where we are.
Well, the argument is that it's one of the symptoms of a rape culture, so that if you don't address the rape culture, you will see all of that. They're not separate. They're not in their own silos.
Yeah.
But is this the beginning of the conversation? I mean, it took women a long time to feel safe enough to come out. And it was precisely the first few revelations that led to this opening of the floodgates that go back decades in some ways. So it took a long time to get the testimony. Will it, you know, should we allow for the time it's going to take to actually change the culture?
And what bothers me, because I wonder if Harvey Weinstein hadn't generated so much ill will in his own professional life that so many people were willing to roll on him.
Yeah.
The Roy Moore effect,
right?
If that was the reason why we're having the conversation,
right,
then we're not really having this conversation in a way that's going to deal directly with the issues, right?
Right, and one of those issues, I mean, which, you know, I'm reminded of when I think about some of the stories that I've read about Harvey Weinstein and the way that he wielded his power. We're talking about toxic masculinity. We're talking about the entitlement and the privilege and the, you know, the ways that men use their power to take advantage of those who they perceive to be, you know,
right,
less powerful, more vulnerable. And I think that's really at the heart of it. And when you think about someone like Roy Moore, who, you know, is preying on teenagers,
mm-hmm,
that's about...
With the Ten Commandments standing by.
That's right. That mm-hmm, that is about a certain type of power,
right,
that comes from feeling insecure, because all of his sort of machinations and shenanigans had the stamp of the district attorney on them. Like, that's what he
right,
would tell the girls, you know? And that's...
We're going to take a break right here. We're going to continue our conversation with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on the state of things in just one moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context, talking about whether or not we're actually at a threshold moment and whether or not we can see a change in the culture given all of the sexual misconduct revelations. And Mark, you're saying no, we're not yet at the
bedrock. No, because we're having a conversation about behavior in the workforce, right? And that's one thing. What stays uninterrogated here, and this is a point that Natalie was just making, we're not interrogating what toxic masculinity is. You hear very little conversation amongst all these conversations about what patriarchy is and how patriarchy functions as almost a default position for many men in America.
Right.
Charlie Rose probably didn't think that he was doing anything wrong, right? So many of these men didn't think they were doing anything wrong, and that comes from the fact that we're not having a conversation about toxic masculinity and patriarchy.
Yeah.
But that's embedded in a much deeper system. That takes a look at an economic system that values competition over collaboration, right? And in a market economy where one has to prove themselves over and over again and where your network means almost nothing, that becomes a much deeper issue. And in fact, your acting out of patriarchy is a foundation. That is one of the...
Absolutely.
That nuclear family and patriarchy is one of the fundamentals of a market economy. How do you get rid of that unless
right,
you overturn the system?
Right.
Or
which,
do you challenge the system?
Which is why you can have a president who claimed to have done what he did
right,
to
allowed,
women and get elected because he
right,
is sort
right,
of this bastion of this
that's
patriarchy.
Right. That's right.
And apparently approval of it. Well, let's talk about whether there's some disparities, too, on the question of being heard, because it is the question also arises in African-American communities. One question is, are we allowing African-American men, do African-American women let black men get away with more? Are they protecting them when they're accused? And I want to play a clip here. This is Tarana Burke, who's of course, the creator of the Me Too hashtag, talking about that very question.
I've said it 100 times, sexual assault doesn't know any race, class, or gender, but the way we respond to it does. And so we can see that in the case of R. Kelly and how all his accusers are black girls, and he still has a prominent position in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's also the notion that because of racism, the various oppressions that we operate under, black women have to almost be complicit in their own abuse in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't report, we don't come forward, because look what happens when we does.
Mm-hmm.
When we do, people tend to not believe you. You get the kind of pushback that is unprecedented in other communities.
Mm-hmm.
I think in general, women, you know, have to deal with not being believed, but we have a whole other layer because people are socialized to believe that black girls are lying, mm-hmm. that we're fast, mm-hmm. that we're, you know, we wanted the attention. Those are the kind of things that we're socialized to believe.
As the creator of the hashtag MeToo, Tarana Burke, on the talk show Essence Now last week. Natalie?
I mean, you know, you saw my head bobbing up and down with everything that Tarana said. You know, I think black women, unfortunately, carry like a double burden because on the one hand, we're expected to protect black men, right? When even when they oppress us, we're expected to not throw them under the bus, not, you know, call the police on them because the police are not going to treat the black man right. And, you know, all these things that then basically do make us complicit in our own oppression. And then on the other hand, because of the way that black women are regarded in society, like, there is no protection, right? We can't even seek out or eke out a protection, a safe space where we can speak about the things that not only black men but white men do to us. But then on top of that, you know, expect to be heard and then, you know, protected and someone care enough to do something about it. So, you know, it is when I think about people like Bill Cosby and R. Kelly and the ways that we, not only as black women, but as a community, tend to protect these men and absolutely tend to blame and for lack of a better phrase, I don't think I'm using it correctly. In fact, I know I'm not, but slut shame, you know, the accusers. We have a lot of work to do when it comes to holding men of privilege and power and celebrity responsible and making them accountable for their bad behavior. You know, we have a long way to go. But I'm reminded of something that Mark has talked about on this show in the past, which is at the same time, because I don't believe in losing black men to a system that is not going to treat them well. How do we bring them back into the fold? How do we redeem them? You know, how do we make a space for forgiveness and reconciliation and healing so that they can then change and transform and, you know, and contribute to the society? And it's, you know, it's a deep question.
Mark?
Even as we're at this moment now where there's a disruption in how we perceive the lives of women in this country, it only reinforces how little value black women have in this context. Yep. Had any of these men been accused of attacking a large majority of black women, we would not be having this conversation right now. We know that because we know of the case of someone like former officer Daniel Holtzclaw in Oklahoma, who raped dozens of black women. And even as I say this now, there are folks who will be first hearing this story for the first time.
That's right.
As I said, and had this been a case of Daniel Holtzclaw attacking white women, or God forbid, right, a black man attacking a black police officer attacking, it would be a whole different kind of conversation. The fact that we don't know the names of R. Kelly's victims, the fact that, you know, that we don't know the cases of so many black women. I think about, you know, what's been happening at Spelman and Morehouse. Mm-hmm. And this is a long history, mm-hmm. right? You go back to Laura Rahman's film, Broken Social Contracts, where she examines a rape case between Spelman and Morehouse in 2006. This is an ongoing narrative, and it highlights the very things that Natalie just talked about. The fact that the women at Spelman are reticent, right, to send the black men of Morehouse, right, this bastion of black masculinity, right, that's going to produce the next generation of the black male middle class, you know, you don't want to send them off, right, into incarceration and law enforcement. But at the same time, what are these women going to have to be subject to in protecting these men?
Right. Well, and that is changing now. So what about the movement on those campuses now to bring more accountability?
I think social media has been a big part of changing that narrative, right? Suddenly, if the universities are not going to be responsive to these issues, if you're talking about the Atlantic, you know, the schools in Atlanta, if the Atlanta Police Department is not going to be responsive to these cases, these women have been able, and with the support of some men, mm-hmm. right, have been able to take to social media to be able to tell their stories. And suddenly we have a narrative that we can grab onto.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I was, excuse me, as Mark was talking about, you know, how we have not, we don't know the names of the accusers of R. Kelly, or if the accusers for a lot of the men that have, you know, recently been accused of assault were Black women, we'd be having a different conversation. And, you know, I cannot help but think about Lupita Nyong'o, who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about her interaction, her engagement with, not engagement, her experience with Harvey Weinstein. And that was the only woman who he directly, like, counteracted.
Nah.
Right. Nah. I don't remember it like that. It didn't go down like that. And that speaks to, like, it doesn't even matter that she's a celebrity. She's an Academy Award winner. She's a Black woman. And so the distance that he is going to place between any sort of, you know, appearance of having been involved sexually with a Black woman or even having harassed her, he's not here for that. And you know, that is basically what we're talking about.
If we address, Mark, getting back to, and what you both said, Natalie, as well, patriarchy, some of the real foundations of not only social but economic order, if we start addressing those, do all of these problems then start to come into focus? Are they all solved at the same time, even though you can see the complexity when you cross the race line of how to manage them separately?
I think as long as we live in a society in which there are men who think that they have the right to have access to women's bodies and women's sexuality, and let's be clear, they have the right not only to women's bodies, but the bodies and sexuality of those folks that they deem as less powerful than them, until we have a very real conversation about that, right? And that's as much about immigration reform, mm-hmm. right? A white man in power dictating where certain brown or, and I'm thinking about in the case of Haiti now, mm-hmm. right? Dictating where Black and brown bodies should go. Until we really address those kinds of issues, right, we're really kind of talking in circles.
And I think capitalism is as much a part of this conversation. It's a maybe indirect qualifier, but it is, it's at the base of what we're dealing with, especially when we think about patriarchy and toxic masculinity and how, you know, the pursuit of money and the power that and right. status that come from that then kind of cultivate this sense of entitlement. I'm above the law. No accountability. You know, that is something that I think is much more difficult to really like get at, and without it being completely dismantled, I don't know that we're able to completely upheave this problem.
But it does become the question whether or not you can fix the parts without fixing the foundation.
Exactly.
Like get the engine to actually work right for all of us.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about a real pioneer in this. There was a Black woman who talked about a Black man and did it very publicly, Anita Hill. And former Vice President Joe Biden was chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee during those hearings. He was challenged recently at the Glamour Women of the Year Summit in New York City. Joe Biden asked by a member of the audience what he would change about Anita Hill's case. And again, the way her testimony was handled before his committee. Then Glamour's editor-in-chief Cindy Levy followed up with this question. Let's listen.
Professor Hill has said herself that she expected a fair process and did not feel that she had one. Do you, given your leadership on these kinds of issues, do you have any message to her now?
Well, my message, which I've delivered before, is I am so sorry if she believed that. I am so sorry that she had to go through what she went through. Think of the courage it took for her to come forward. And initially, when it came forward, she didn't come forward. Initially, it came forward anonymously. And the question was, would I put it in the record anonymously? But she had the courage to come and say, no, I'll come and testify. And she got put through hell during that process. And if you remember, and if you watch that, the shouting arguments I had with those witnesses who were attacking her. And so, but I feel really badly she didn't feel like the process worked. But I tell you what, I said something at the time that proved to be right. I said, this is going to be the start of a fundamental change in what constitutes harassment in the workplace, and people are going to begin to change. And it began to change because of her courage.
Former Vice President Joe Biden talking with Glamour's editor-in-chief Cindy Levy at Glamour Women of the Year Summit last week. Was that an apology?
Nope. Not apology at all. Because let me tell you something. He first says if, I'm sorry if she felt, which is a disclaimer in and of itself, right? If she felt badly about the process, but then he says she was put through hell. So which is it, Joe? You know, like,
well, let me ask you about that. Does he need to apologize? He voted no when it came to Clarence Thomas's actual nomination, said, you know, I believe her. This is so no, Clarence Thomas, you are not fit to be a Supreme Court justice. And this is a process that he has to oversee. And there's some people who are going to be pretty rough on you. Not my party.
But didn't he also, wasn't he in charge of basically
the committee? Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, so, he runs the show, but there's some, you know, opposition.
There's some nuance. I'll allow for some nuance.
I mean, he voted no because it was politically expedient for him to vote no. You know, there's a way in which had he had an honest and woke conversation about gender, you know, back in 2008 instead of 2017, he might have been the nominee and Barack Obama might have been the vice president.
Right.
It just seems to me that he's collapsing. He's going where the shift is now and looking at his future political aspirations and shoring up support. Right. And this is a glaring example. And still, even in that context, he couldn't say a strong, you know, a strong enough apology that folks would go, okay. Because immediately everybody right. is like, I mean, he got dragged on social media. It's like, and folks love Joe,
mm-hmm,
right?
Exactly.
You know, Joe's everybody's favorite uncle, but even your favorite uncle couldn't go that next level to really acknowledge a blind spot that he had in terms of gender, sexuality, and patriarchy.
That's
in
right.
this case.
I want to shift gears now and talk about a new movie, Mudbound. Netflix released the film this past Friday, and it focuses on two families living in the Mississippi Delta before, during, and after World War II. One family, African-American, working as sharecroppers. The other, a white family who owns the land. Let's listen to this clip featuring a voiceover from the father of the black family talking about their family's history as sharecroppers.
My grandfathers and great uncles, grandmothers and great aunts, father and mother, broke, tilled, tall. Planted, plucked, raised, burned, broke again. Worked this land all they lie. This land that never would be theirs. They worked until they sweated. They sweated until they bled. They bled until they died. Died with the dirt of this same 200 acres under their fingernails. Died clawing at the hard, brown back that would never be theirs.
That's a clip from Mudbound. My guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal for another installment of Back Channel. Natalie?
I watched Mudbound really hoping and expecting that because the director is a black gay woman, that the representations of black people would be, drawn, painted in a certain way. And I think in a lot of ways she tried to do that. But maybe it's because I have a lot of conversations about who gets to tell the story and the fact that in film, and that we've talked about this here quite a few times, when white people tell stories about black people, and I realize that Mudbound is about two different families, one white, one black, at the same time there is... So Dee Reese directs the film, but it's based on a book that was written by a white woman. So I'm still feeling like there is this insensitivity and almost a presumption of understanding our experience. Also, the insensitivity comes in because of the trauma that we are still exposed to. When the older son is almost, spoiler alert, lynched. So I did not love this film. I really wanted to. I really wanted to feel like, you know, yeah, Dee, this is awesome. And I felt like that about Pariah, her first film, and I felt like that about Bessie. But this one really messed with me still in ways I'm still processing.
Mark?
It speaks, I think, on some level to the limits of what happens when you have a director like Dee Reese who does a quote-unquote Hollywood film, even as it's using an alternative method in terms of Netflix and what have you, to not be able to tell the story the way that she wants to tell it. You know, that being said, what you realize is that because this is a Hollywood film, we spend a lot of time dealing with the humanity of these white folks.
yes,
and too. And if you throw off the lens of thinking about this at all as a film about black people, what you see is a film about some really damaged, broken white folks. And I think there's something of value in that narrative because it's something that we don't see enough. You know, we already go to the film with the assumption that the black folks are broken.
Right.
We know that for historical reasons, right? But, you know, we're not dealing with a white family here that's living high off the hog, that's privileged. They're in that mud with these black folks, right? And even if there's still a pecking order, if you will, a hierarchy within the context of that, you know, none of these folks come away as heroes. I felt as though, again, spoiler alert, that the ending was almost a false ending, right? It was a Hollywood ending to something that didn't deserve that kind of ending, right? We needed it to end the way that it felt. This is a dirty, nasty, gritty film about race in mid-20th century American South. And the father, right, who's the one voice that we don't hear inside his head, right, the father of the white patriarch, I mean, it's like you can't imagine dudes like this. I mean, this is just like the epitome of the nasty old racist who in some ways allows for us to look at more contemporary racist figures in almost in a loving sense because he, in fact, is so evil. Mm.
Right? But you also, I think, Pappy, the white patriarch, also, and what a name, right? but he also, I think, is a window to what we are seeing in Charlottesville,
absolutely.
What we are seeing in Tennessee, like all of the white nationalist neo-Nazi activity that we have seen, and even just the general mindset of the still 30-something percent of folk who support Trump is kind of wrapped up in Pappy.
We're going to continue our conversation in this edition of Back Channel in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and my guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal, joining us for another installment of Back Channel, connecting culture and context. And before the break, we were talking about the Netflix film Mudbound, two families, one black, one white, before and after the Second World War. Mark, you were sort of making the point about, and Natalie was just making the point at the break about the, you know, about the kind of the unsatisfactory ending of this film that you didn't feel that it was it that it's not nuanced enough, that the families don't reflect, you know, sort of the full life of.
It felt as though it was edited so that folks would leave the theater feeling good about what they just watched. And there was nothing good to feel about it. In fact, that's the only feel good moment in the movie at the end. So it feels disingenuous, right? It feels dishonest to have ended the film the way that the film ends.
I want to play a clip here. This is the returning black soldier, now returning from World War II, named Ron Zell. And he's confronted by a group of white men when he tries to leave through the front door. Let's listen.
Where do you think you're going, boy?
I beg your pardon, sir. I'm just trying to get home to see my folks.
Not that way, you ain't.
Pappy, this is Ron Zell. Happen Florence's son, just returned from overseas.
Well, that explains why you're trying to leave by the front door. You must be confused as to your whereabouts.
No, sir, I'm not confused at all.
Oh, I think you are, boy. I don't know what they let you do over there, but you in Mississippi now, nigga. You use the back door.
Go on, son. Son, we don't want no trouble here. Go on. Go on.
You know what? You're absolutely right. When we was overseas, they didn't make us use the back door. General Patton put us on the front line. Yes, sir. And you know what we did? He kicked the hell out of Hitler and them Jerrys. Are y'all at home safe and sound?
That's a clip from the film Mudbound. I'm talking to popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel.
Now, that was a great line, I have to say. You know, what Ron Zell says to Pappy and his older son. You know, I keep thinking about Monster's Ball. Not for the movie that Halle Berry won an Academy Award for some years back, because this generational, I think one of the things that sort of is interesting to me about Mudbound is that we've got Pappy, who is a straight up racist. Then we've got the older son, who's a moderate racist. And then we have Jamie, who is, you know, because he fought with African-American soldiers, it's like he's very progressive. And it's similar to the dynamic that exists in Monsters Ball, where the main character's father is racist, he's moderate, his son has none of that in him and actually commits suicide, you know, because he's not like them. And so I'm saying, like, this sort of pattern.
Yeah, it's the Goldilocks pattern, right?
Yeah, and I while it's interesting, I think that that's a part of what, for me, feels, you know, besides the ending to the film, this I think that there is complexity in families, in white families, certainly, in terms of race and where different people stand on that. But I felt like there were a lot of ways that this film tries to force us to believe, as Mark said, that, you know, white folks are at the end of the day, they good. You know, they really do care about them niggas.
What was the line in the New York Times article? I think the New York Times Review said something about, you know, in the end, black lives matter less than white consciences.
Mm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is some of that. I want to switch gears again. I want to talk about the case of rapper Meek Mill. This month, Meek Mill was sentenced to 2 to 4 years in prison for violating his probation, but in protest in response to the sentencing in Philadelphia in support of Meek Mill's release. The hashtag Free Meek. Mark, tell us about this, about the case and what's going on here.
You know, it's basically a case where he was convicted of something as a youth offender and had to do certain kinds of things to stay out of jail, and he didn't. And it was very clear that the judge gave him a sentence that was extraordinary to some extent. And some of the conversation about it has been about the fact that there has been such a support for him. Prominent folks have come out to speak against it. You know, Jay-Z, Sean Carter wrote an op-ed in the New York Times responding to it. And this is, of course, following up on the work that he did earlier this year around these kinds of issues. And I think it's an interesting case because on the one hand, we're only talking about it because it is Meek Mill. And to some extent, we only know about Meek Mill because there's a relationship with
right, to Jay-Z.
To Jay-Z and also
the Drake thing.
The Drake thing,
yeah.
Right. But I think there's, you know, the point to be made is that somehow we have to be able to utilize celebrity to have these conversations, because whatever Meek Mill did that's stupid, that's causing him to go to jail for this period of time, there are thousands of black men and women, black men and women who were youthful offenders who do these same stupid things, who don't have protections.
That's right.
So if we don't find a way to have this conversation with the most visible of these folks, we're not going to have the conversation with folks who are virtually invisible.
That's right. I think that even though, yes, Meek Mill did basically, or technically, is the term, violate the terms of his probation. Well, right. At the same time, I have to say that I think that the punishment is severe. So if Meek Mill is, you know, an example of what happens when you violate the terms of your probation technically, and he's a celebrity and he's going to jail, then, you know, along the same lines of what Mark was just saying, imagine what's happening to these nameless, you know, voiceless black people, black and brown people who are being sent to jail, you know, for doing the same thing. But how much worse might their punishment be?
Well, again, then, and we get down to the granular level, because of the way we cover this, we're going to get chapter and verse, every quote, every crime. We're going to get the whole yellow sheet. But the question is, what's the system that keeps putting people in prison for particular crimes? And it begins in schools with SROs, you know, arresting children for mouthing off. And now you've got a record. And now the judge can say, you cannot do a concert in the next county. Well, that's my livelihood. And so, yeah, that's going to violate my parole. But that's how I make my living. And so if it starts in middle school and right. we didn't look at that system that put you there,
that's
then
right.
the question of sort of whether or not you should have done what the judge said, if that's the only thing you're going to debate, you're probably not going to get very far.
Right. And this is at a time where we're having conversations. You know, ProPublica did this great series about Walking While Black and how cities like Jacksonville are over incarcerating black people for minor walking infractions, right? Stuff that most folks don't even know there's a law for. So this stuff goes hand in hand, right? It's an ongoing effort to over-incarcerate, to over-arrest, you know, people of color. And Meek Mill is just one of the most visible examples of this at this particular moment. He won't be the last.
And I just want to add that it's, you know, I think a lot of people, and I certainly did, would think that the judge who handed down this sentence was somebody white and male, possibly, and it's a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, you know, interesting for a variety of reasons, which we may not have the time to get into. But I do want to say that I think that oftentimes, you know, black people get excited about patriarchy and aligning themselves with whiteness and aspirations of power and status that play out in these arenas. And, you know, and we see this type of over supervision of other black people. And I think it's really about respectability politics,
that
this is how you're supposed to act, Meek Mill.
Well, if that's how the machine works, it kind of doesn't matter who's sitting in the driver's seat and operating the levers. That's how this machine works.
Right.
And so that's part of what we see. We see black police officers charged with police brutality. It doesn't.
Right.
And so to that extent, it does matter how the game is set and how the rules are written. And that makes kind of a difference. And then you can switch the players out pretty easily.
Yeah. Your skin folk ain't your kin folk.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about another one. This is the thriller Get Out. We've talked about the film before on this program. Big success earlier this year, written and directed by Jordan Peele. Also well known for a sketch comedy. And then there's the comedy show Key and Peele, of course. So it's announced that Get Out will be nominated in the comedy category for this year's Golden Globes. Backlash against that because, you know, Jordan Peele said it's not a comedy. it's a thriller. What do you make of this, though? Because this is something that goes on, this so-called category fraud. It's not unique to films made and written by black artists. It's a thing that you do to win an award. So what do you make of this particular one? I'll start with you, Natalie.
I mean, I think it's laughable that Get Out would be deemed, you know, a comedy. But I think that it's a little more insidious than just trying to put this film in a category that will give it a better chance of winning an award and sort of setting it up for the Academy Awards later. I really feel like that, you know, that in some ways there is an effort to minimize the gravity of what Jordan Peele is trying to say in Get Out. It might be subconscious, but there's an imposition of this, you know, let's make light of this film because it is so serious. I mean, he's making some he's lodging some real challenges against white supremacy
racism. Let's hear what Jordan Peele said on CBS this morning when he was asked about the film.
How important was it to include comedy, obviously not taking away from the drama and the thriller that the movie really is?
It's pretty important. You know, I'm putting my audience through a lot with this movie. A lot of tension, a lot of uncomfortable situations. It is, and there are moments it's hard to watch. There's moments you want to scream, get out.
Right. Yes.
And so where, you know, little Rel Howery, who plays Rod, you know, his character was kind of the release valve for the audience. And it was important for me that he comes in and he speaks the truth too. So there's no line that's intended for, there's no jokes in the movie. It's all meant to feel true. It's all meant to kind of feel like the most true thriller, horror thriller we've seen so far.
All right, there's a clip of writer and director Jordan Peele on the CBS This Morning program earlier this year. Mark?
If I'm being honest, there's not a film that I watched that I laughed in the theater watching the film more than Get Out. And that's not to say that I thought the film was funny necessarily. I think in the best case scenario, it was a high form of satire, right, which is going to generate certain kind of uncomfortable responses. And part of my response to that really has to do with the fact that some of the situations that the main character was in my mind, was laughable, right? Because you know, I'm of a generation that was raised not to make those kinds of decisions, right?
Right.
But you were yelling, get out.
Right. But that's not the audience for this film, right? Yeah. We're dealing with a generation that's come up under a different kind of race politics in which what we see on screen is very real, right, to them, as it was for Jordan Peele making the film. But I think Natalie's point is well taken. You know, what we're looking at is the devaluing of the impact that the film has. We always see the case where those films that get nominated for the Golden Globes in the comedy arena don't make it to best film status for the Academy Awards. The performances that get recognized in terms of the comedy role don't get recognized in terms of best and supporting actor and actresses. So this is very real. The question, of course, then becomes how much do we want to value these awards processes in this case, right? Yeah. The fact of the matter is a very good film that was done that caused us to have a very real conversation about race and trauma, and whether or not it gets recognized in whatever category, for me, is really secondary to the point.
Mark, I want to talk about an upcoming project from Smithsonian Folkways that you are a part of in some ways. Smithsonian Folkways teamed up with the National Museum of African American History and Culture to release a box set of the Anthology of Hip Hop and Rap, and you're part of this committee that's organizing and selecting material. Tell us more about the project.
Yeah, Timothy Ann Burnside, who's overseeing this with Chuck D, who's the first person who came on of Public Enemy. You know, Folkways decided, particularly with the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, that they wanted to embark on a collection of hip hop that looks like those incredible, you know, folk collections by Folkways and the jazz collection. Let's do that with hip hop. And so we're talking about 114 songs. And of course, given the landscape that we're in with music now, in order to make this successful, they had to do some sort of crowdfunding in order to get it done. And they were able to do that successfully, twice as much as what they asked for, which speaks to the fact that, you know, folks are very interested in this project. And it offers a great pedagogical tool, I think, to talk about hip hop in the context of what we see as not just African-American culture, but American culture.
I mean, the only thing that I would add is that I just found out about it maybe 4 days ago. And as soon as I found out about it, I ordered it because it's that type of collection that you have to have, you know, it just, especially if you're of a certain age and generation. And I came up, you know, on Sugar Hill Gang and the beginnings of hip hop, even though I was a house music baby in Chicago. But it's important to me to have this sort of collection of material that means a lot to, you know, my childhood and
cover art, too, the art that goes with it. Right?
I can tell you, you know, it was a room full of, you know, incredible folks, the MC Lights, Jeff Chang, Chuck D, who I mentioned, scholars like Cheryl Keys, who sat around the table. And, you know, we started. Ninth Wonder was also part of this process. And for those folks who purchase a certain version of it, they'll get a mix of all these songs from Ninth Wonder. But we started out with close to 1,000 songs and trying to figure a way to reflect on the wholeness of the culture. And even those things about the culture that we might not like, because we have to be representative, to be able to whittle it down to 100 or so songs was, you know, a pretty
amazing
experience.
I'd like to be in on those meetings. Yeah. They get hot. They probably get a little hot, right? That's a lot of
music. There were some disagreements.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to the box set. Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. He's an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black, and Natalie Bullock Brown, a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh and an Emmy-nominated producer and filmmaker. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more about us at our website, stateofthings.org, produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.